Sex isn't about actions. It's about sensations and connections with other people.
In the first segment of our two-chapter foray into the totally wild subject of sex and space, we looked at the technology that's changing our conception of the subject. How are the mechanics of fertility evolving? Now, in this episode's conclusion, what about love? We've previously touched a little bit on the culture of our new world, and in this episode, that is going to be our primary focus. The human relationship. How is that evolving on Earth, and how might it evolve on an alien planet? We've built Mars into a habitable world, but the mission is not complete until our new branch of human civilization is self-sustaining and emotionally healthy.
One, sex is about human social connection, and human social connection is going to be really intense in a colonial situation so far away from the lives that people were tethered to. The life support system isn't just going to be the hardware and technology. It's going to be the people that you are sharing your life with. To have the conflict between people because of sex be a factor in life not being stable and high quality and successful on Mars would be a tragedy.
Working into the topic of relationships on Mars, it's of course essential to take a look at relationships in general. How do they work, and how are they evolving here on Earth? My colleague, Alex Silverman, sat down with an expert in the field.
I'm Emily Nagoski. I am a very nerdy sex educator, and I wrote a book called Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life.
Emily has a master's in counseling and a PhD in health behavior with a concentration in human sexuality from Indiana University, where she worked with some of the greatest minds in the world of sex science, including at IU's Kinsey Institute, founded by Alfred Kinsey in 1947 and responsible for benchmark-setting research in human sexuality through to today. Emily's New York Times bestselling book, Come As You Are, includes findings from Kinsey, Gottman, and other institutes and labs, and from her years as wellness education director and lecturer at Smith College. When we first proposed the topic of sex and relationships on Mars, Emily warned us that she had some major concerns.
I think traveling through space to Mars and then in an early colony on a foreign planet, there might be some high stress. And when I first framed this conversation to you, you said that your response was that your thoughts on the subject might be pretty dark.
Super dark.
Okay, so let me just hit me with where that's coming from, what your thoughts are, anything you got.
Yeah, so a bunch of humans from Earth get in a spaceship and they fly to a different planet and they build a civilization there. The thing is, they have brought with them all of their cultural learning about sexuality.
Emily's work has shown that what we're told to think about sexuality doesn't generally align with what the research suggests, and that mistaken beliefs can lead to less fun sex, conflict, limits on bodily autonomy, and sometimes violence. We don't want to bring that stuff to Mars. We discuss some of the research Emily presents in her book that could help course correct, beginning with a model for human sexual response called the dual control model.
The starting point for Come As You Are is the reality that the general cultural understanding of how human sexuality works is fundamentally and in every way mistaken, and we sort of need to start from scratch if we want to have a science-based understanding of how human sexuality works. For me, the foundation of that is this idea called the dual control model. Eric Jansen and John Bancroft, then at the Kinsey Institute, were the originators of this model that says, holy crap, what if sexuality works the same way as sort of everything in the human nervous system, which is as a coupling of accelerators and brakes? So that's why it's called the dual control model, because there's two parts, to simplify it. And the accelerator responds to all the sexually relevant information in the environment, everything that you see, hear, smell, touch, taste, or imagine that your brain codes as sex-related, and it sends the turn-on signal. But at the same time and in parallel, your sexual brakes are noticing all the very good reasons not to be turned on right now. Everything that you see, hear, smell, touch, taste, or imagine that your brain codes as a potential threat. And it sends the turn off signal. And they are both functioning all the time, including right now. The fact that we're talking about sex is a little bit sexually relevant. So you've got a little bit. So they're both functioning simultaneously all the time, including right now. And the process of becoming aroused is therefore this dual process of turning on the ons and turning off the offs. And usually when people read advice for people who are struggling with arousal, desire, orgasm, most of the advice centers around increasing stimulation to the accelerator. But it's very rare that a difficulty would be caused by lack of stimulation to the accelerator. It's almost always because there's too much stimulation to the brake. So that's sort of like the foundational way to understand how sexuality functions in an individual human. What are the things that hit their accelerator? What are the things that hit their brakes?
What are some common brakes?
So probably the most common break is stress and other forms of negative emotion. 80 to 90% of people, when they're feeling stressed, have a reduction or at least a little bit of an impact on their interest in sex. 10 to 20% of people will actually experience an increase in their interest in sex. That's not an increase in pleasure, but an increase in their interest in sex. But for the majority of people, it's like the number one thing is stress. The second most common, I would say, is some form of concern about your body or your sexuality, which is sort of ironic that your worry about your sex life would be one of the key things that interferes with your sex life. But the idea that you're doing it wrong or that your body's not good enough or that it's in some way dangerous is almost universal among people that I talk to, particularly among women.
If there are sexual accelerators and breaks, and stress is the most common break, then that's something to be aware of, to plan for. Because traveling to Mars and colonizing an alien world is probably going to be stressful. Another framework Emily discusses in her book defines the types of desire an individual can experience as spontaneous, responsive, and contextual. Spontaneous is out of the blue, no stimulation required, desire for sex. Responsive desire emerges in response to pleasure, like you're not thinking about sex until somebody touches you or kisses you. And context here means that circumstances and state of mind affect ability to feel sexual desire. On context, Emily had this to say.
So to think about context, think about tickling, right? If you're in a flirty, fun, playful state of mind, tickling is not everybody's favorite, but just imagine a world where you're in a fun, flirty state of mind, your partner starts tickling you, and that could potentially feel fun and good and lead to other things. But if that exact same person tries to tickle you when you're pissed off at them, how does that feel?
Right. So that's a good example of context.
Right. And this is happening at a neurological level. The nucleus accumbens is actually shifting the kind of activation that it responds with, depending on the context. So when your brain is in a stressed state, the nucleus accumbens shifts to 90% threat response. Whereas if you are in a safe, homey, comfortable environment, 90% of the nucleus accumbens shifts to approach motivation. So you'll explore things that in an unsafe situation, you might not explore. So at a really fundamental level, our curiosity is shaped by our level of capacity to cope with the stressors around us. When I say that responsive desire emerges in response to pleasure, really what I'm saying is that emerges in response to a context that allows your brain to interpret the world as a safe, sexy, fun place. So it's not like under any circumstances your skin touching your partner's skin is going to light the fire. It's that your skin touching your partner's skin in the right context will light the fire. So it's about creating the right context and learning how to create that context on the journey there. And once you get there, that's brand new territory.
Context is a big question mark for Mars. There's no precedent, no great way to predict how people will feel and interact on the way to and on an alien world.
And we have no idea what it's going to be. We have no idea if the adventure of it is going to be super exciting and everybody's going to want to like just have sex all the time because it's super exciting. If it's going to be really stressful, but people will be so reliant on each other that they'll find themselves motivated to engage sexually to reinforce their bonds with the people on whom their life very literally depends. Or it might be so stressful that they find their interest in sex just evaporates.
Whatever the more likely scenario, we have work to do. Emily has spent her career trying to improve sexual and general well-being for people here on Earth. We talked about putting our best foot forward on Mars and the training we'll likely need. First, Emily reminds us that we'll be bringing a set of beliefs with us. And moral codes are probably best built flexibly because our thoughts on what's good and healthy tend to evolve. maybe this is a fantasy. Let me know what you think. But I think there's a chance that we get to actually rewrite all of that baggage that we've been taught here. All of our hangups, all of the things that culture is telling us we don't have permission to do. I think that we could build a culture on Mars that has a lot more respect for sexual autonomy and that, you know, creates more space for different people to be themselves. And I don't know, what do you think about that?
I have so many thoughts about that. I have so many thoughts. So my skeptical thought, because...
Let's have it, yeah.
No, well, okay, so I'll get the skeptical one out of the way because I have lots of optimistic ones too. My skeptical thought is that the Puritans came to America with a vision of how we should be sexually with each other.
Not a good
one. Right. So the idea that these colonists would also be going with like a moral position on the way sexuality works. I just want to point out that even if that morality aligns with what I believe and what the science suggests to me, results in the happiest, most peaceful, most pleasurable sex lives for everybody, it's not a morality. It is a moral code. You're carrying a moral code to Mars. So that's the dark part. The positive part is I agree that with education, people can unlearn the destructive, certainly interfering with sexual pleasure, cultural messages that they have absorbed. And when they've done that, especially if they do it as a group, they develop a shared vocabulary to replace the toxic vocabulary. Like they can talk about things that hit the accelerator and things that hit the brake. They can talk about context. We didn't talk about the brain science of context, but that shit is awesome.
Yep.
And is like a whole other piece of what I think is going to happen on Mars. They'll know that responsive desire that emerges in response to pleasure rather than in anticipation of pleasure, is normal and healthy, and nobody needs to feel bad or ashamed about the way they experience desire. And just the idea that nobody needs to feel bad or ashamed of their sexuality by itself will help everybody have conversations about sex.
I asked Emily what she thought about sending couples to Mars. Initially, she laughed at me. So one strategy or kind of tactic for the early stage of getting our first settlers to Mars is I thought we could potentially reduce some of these concerns, and of course not all of them, and maybe introduce other challenges. But what if we sent couples? Like, what if we vetted and sent like healthy?
Couples never have sexual problems.
Hey, no. I know. Push back hard. But okay, if we send couples, what Pandora's boxes are we opening, and what kind of stressors are we reducing? Or like healthy couples,
happy couples who use evidence-based strategies to sustain a strong connection no matter what. And there are couples. One of the things about stress is that when you go through it collaboratively with another person, that enhances your bond with that person. Marriages could absolutely be strengthened. Partnerships of all kinds can be strengthened by surviving the inevitable adversities that you're going to confront in this sort of experience. So it could be great for the couples who have those skills. Couples who sustain strong sexual connections over multiple decades have two things in common. One, they have really strong friendships at the foundation of their relationship. It has nothing to do with like passionate lust, can't wait to stick my tongue down your throat. It's all about friendship. Are you there for me? Is the ultimate question to ask. Only if you know for sure your partner is going to be there for you, can you relax enough into trust to be able to like put your naked body against this other person's naked body. So number one, they have a strong friendship at the foundation of their relationship. And number two, they prioritize sex. They decide that it matters. It's a deliberate choice rather than something that just kind of happens in sexuality. So if they go into this experience knowing that they're going to need to allocate like Fridays at 3:00, however time works, I don't know, but they agree that there's going to be a time when they will get together in their private space, because private is a much more characteristic feature of human sexuality than for other animals. Even the other great apes, our closest relatives, bonobo chimpanzees and standard chimpanzees, both have sex in relative public, whereas humans across cultures and across time have sex in relative private. So our couple will decide to go and have sex in their private space, whatever that sex looks like for them. Maybe it's just cuddling and talking. Maybe it is genitals in genitals. that's up to them. It's whatever feels good. But they've done it not because they were like super horny and couldn't wait, but because they know that shared experience of pleasure powerfully reinforces their connection with each other, which matters so much in a situation like this.
Yeah, and I think, as awkward as that sound, a lot of that in the early stages, things might have to be planned in that way because you are sharing space on a tin can going through space or a small settlement.
But I mean, there's the same sort of like sharing bathroom spaces. You just figure out ways to manage your boundaries.
Yeah. And I think these people wouldn't, again, just be plucked off the street. I think this will be part of the conversation.
Years of preparation, for sure.
Yeah. I think about this kind of...
Oh, man, I want everyone now to go through this preparation and they would all have much better sex lives.
I agree.
Let's prepare everyone as if they're about to go to Mars.
Wow. To create a best case scenario on Mars, one of the most important things that people have to learn to do is to cope with uncomfortable feelings. We talked about how things might look in a culture that facilitates great sex for everyone, and how sending a small, motivated group of people to a new world has baked in incentives.
The thing is, it's incredibly complicated. Sexuality isn't one thing. There's the stuff that happens in my body. There's the stuff that happens in my relationship. There's the stuff that happens in my community. And there's the stuff that happens globally. I'm really interested in the consequences of creating a context with great sex, because almost all of the solution to our problems around sex as a culture actually have nothing to do with sex. Most of them have to do with learning to tolerate uncomfortable emotions and live with each other in close proximity while experiencing uncomfortable emotions. When we teach people how to tolerate the uncomfortable feelings that they will definitely be experiencing, fortunately, we're likely to be choosing people with secure attachment styles, with great relationship and communication skills, who know how to take personal responsibility for their choices and aren't afraid to ask for help when they need it without making someone else responsible for their own feelings. I'm sure people are going to come with that proneness and we'll teach them skills, because there are absolutely evidence-based skills that we can teach people of how to maximize communication in their relationships of all kinds. And there'll be people who have learned to trust their bodies when their bodies go to uncomfortable places. And feelings are tunnels. You have to go through the darkness to get to the light at the end. There's going to be a whole lot of tunnels emotionally on Mars. And the key to success, especially in interpersonal relationships, is going to be every individual's capacity to go through the tunnels of their own emotional experience and to ask for help when they get lost in the dark.
I really loved this idea of having to get comfortable with uncomfortable emotions. And it, of course, applies in all kinds of contexts, not just on Mars, but also here on Earth. I grabbed coffee at a diner before work the other day, and there was a kid there, maybe 7 or 8, with his dad. They were at a booth, and the dad asked his son first if they could sit on the same side, next to each other. A little weird because they were alone, but the kid said yes, and I noticed he was kind of sad and quiet with this look on his face I then recognized as the I'm in trouble face. The dad sat down and then calmly asked his son why he'd behaved the way he did earlier in the day. Son didn't know. So the dad slowly broke apart what he observed. This wasn't necessarily the truth, but it's what he saw, he said. The son said all that sounded right, and then the kind of really cute part, they started troubleshooting better approaches to navigating anger. Together, we all get mad sometimes, the dad said. It was just like beautiful to watch. And this whole thing, managing anger in the relationship context, also came up with our next guest. In this episode, after our kind of relationship foundation, I wanted to get a little more weird. Mars is alien. So what does an alien relationship look like? The closest thing to that I could think of here on Earth was the kind of stuff Robert Heinlein loved to write about in his science fiction novels back in the 50s. So let's talk about polyamory. People tend to get a lot wrong on this topic, which is of course expected with anything taboo. But what I think is really interesting here is both of our political, cultural poles take this one in an odd direction.
I think there's two factions, weirdly. There's like a conservative faction that says lifelong sexually exclusive monogamy is both natural and ethical and sanctioned by religion. And yes, it's sometimes difficult, but that's the only feasible way that you can have stable families. And then there's kind of a far left assumption among some polyamorists that says our ancestors were into free love and they were basically one big commune of unlimited sexual freedom and they didn't really form pair bonds. And that's natural and that's normal and that's how everybody should be. And I have a kind of intermediate position that says pair bonds run deep, but they've never been sexually exclusive for most people. They typically haven't been lifelong. And you can raise kids and have stable family structures without having a kind of trad life Christian monogamy as your only model for how to do that.
Jeffrey Miller is a professor of evolutionary psychology at the University of New Mexico. He's worked on human sexuality and relationships and the origins of our mate preferences for 30 years. Everyone's familiar with innovation in San Francisco and technology, but Jeffrey and I talked about a different kind of San Francisco innovation. The kind pertaining to relationships and sex. We talked about the evolution of human relationships dating back to prehistory and the hunter-gatherer, and then we got into polyamory. What is it? Why is it taboo? Why can't we talk about this? And if a worthwhile idea, how might we prepare ourselves for something like it? Can we be prepared for something like it? We talked about managing jealousy rather than our culture's current practice of, in a super weird way, expecting it. We talked about emotional development and the kinds of people more suited to alternative relationships. And this is where we talked about the heteroflexible astronaut. I had this episode I was working on. It was just sex, specifically what does reproduction look like in the future? So artificial gametes, turning skin cells into stem cells into egg cells and sperm cells, babies in a bag, so artificial gestation. And then I started thinking, like, what about the actual sex, though? What about what about, like, life? How are people gonna fall in love? And out here in San Francisco, I am surrounded by a lot of kind of new structures, new dating paradigms, you would say. And I thought it would be cool to just talk about that. There are not too many people who are willing to talk seriously about this stuff. And I thought we would just have a conversation about it.
Yeah, I'd love that. I mean, the Bay Area is such a hotbed for technical innovation, but it's also a hotbed of relationship innovation. And the two aren't usually talked about together, but I think the same kinds of folks who are fascinated by the technical and physical challenges of Mars colonization are often fascinated by different ways to have sexual relationships and different ways to fall in love and get along.
Yeah, certainly this has been my experience. I mean, through something like Burning Man, it was always from its inception. It was technology and art, but there was this really strong contingent of just social experimentation as well. I guess just before we launch into the new stuff, what has a relationship been, you know, for the past couple hundred years?
Yeah, I mean, the way I think about human sexual relationships is there's multiple phases. There's sort of the hunter-gatherer life that we had up until a couple thousand years ago with civilization. And in hunter-gatherer life, you get long-term pair bonds. People fall in love and they do mutual mate choice and they form relationships, but it's not sexually exclusive, lifelong, institutionalized monogamy. It's much more fluid than that. It's a lot more flexible. And then you get the monotheistic religions kind of encouraging people to do lifelong fidelity and marriage and have a bunch of kids, but never stray. And then basically since the era of the Apollo program, the last 50 years, we have people exploring all kinds of new alternatives to that kind of trad life system. We have people trying out free love and swinging and BDSM, role play, polyamory, open relationships, monogamish relationships. And some of those work really well. Some of them don't work very well. But there's been an amazing amount of experimentation and many, many lessons learned. A lot of hard-won wisdom comes out of those experimental subcultures. And I think it would be insane if we didn't borrow some of those insights to think about how we would structure the kind of mating market and family life on Mars.
I would love it if you could just maybe make the argument for polyamory for me. What does the world look like in which polyamory works? Let's actually drill down. Let's get a little smaller. What does a polyamorous relationship look like?
Well, most polyamorous relationships, somebody has a primary partner. They do have a long-term committed stable pair bond. So there are those long-term commitments. And then you often have secondary partners on the side who also sometimes are quite long-term or medium-term. So you might be spending like 80% of your time with one person, and then maybe another 15% of your time with maybe a couple of other people who you see every few days or once a week or once a month or whatever. And then you might have occasional kind of one-off interactions with people. You might have so-called comets, people you might see once a year if they happen to be visiting town. But most of your attention is still in the pair bond for most people who do poly. So it's not like you're running around, you know, seeing a different person every night and you have seven lovers in parallel and, you know, you have that many plates spinning. Usually it ends up being kind of monogamish, like it's mostly monogamous, but with some other relationships on the side.
I mean, you said it's not like you're running around with seven different relationships, but it could be that. I mean, polyamory is sort of saying maybe every relationship's going to be its own thing. It's going to be unique.
Yeah. I mean, there's different varieties of poly. So what you just described would be what they call relationship anarchy, which is a view that each relationship should sort of follow its own course and there shouldn't really be definitions or expectations or even necessarily long-term commitments. I think relationship anarchy, personally, I think it doesn't work. I think people want stability, security, commitment, especially if they have kids together. What I was describing with the primary and the secondary partners is called hierarchical polyamory, where you do say to people, look, I prioritize my pair bond. That's the most important thing to me. You're also important, but honestly, not as much. And then people kind of know where they stand and they know what to expect.
I'm having a hard time even just thinking about what questions I could ask here because this topic is so taboo. It's like it's perceived almost immediately as weird, as, you know, you don't want two people to be together forever. You know, you must be some strange gross person. How have you navigated in your research just what other people think? Have you avoided that and just focused on your research?
Oh, it's really tricky. I mean, I'm not really like a polyamory researcher. I've taught one class on the psychology of polyamory and open relationships. And I got a certain amount of flack for doing that from my fellow professors. But there's now pretty good scientific literature on polyamory, its pros and cons, how it works, what kinds of people can do it well. And there's still a huge amount of stigma. There's more prejudice against non-monogamous people than against any, you know, ethnic group or religious group or anybody else in America. It's heavily, heavily stigmatized. But hey, if we're going to a new world and we're starting from scratch, you know, on a red desert, it's really important to get it right. Think about it this way. Imagine we send 10 men and 10 women to Mars. Chances are some of them are going to die, okay? There will be widows and widowers. What are they going to do? Are they just going to turn asexual for the rest of their lives without partners because everyone else is mated? Or imagine everyone does pair up and they all survive, but there's an affair, there's an infidelity. What are you going to have then? Drama, jealousy, breakups, factions. Do you really want to threaten the survival of the whole colony with something as fragile as an expectation of lifelong monogamous exclusivity? It seems insane to do it that way, because what you really want is a sort of anti-fragile system where the sexual relationships can deal with shocks and stresses and people dying and new colonists arriving and so forth. And if you don't build in some anti-fragility, the colony is going to fall apart.
This is interesting. The idea that, like, biologically speaking, the human might not be this monogamous creature. We do see animals that pair for life, but it's more complex in the Homo sapien. Is that your position?
It's more complex because the animals that pair for life don't live in social tribes. They don't really have many options. You know, they form nests together if they're birds and they just raise their chicks and they don't really interact very much with other birds. Whereas humans are hyper social primates. We've lived in clans and tribal groups for millions of years and interacted with a range of people. There are no examples of kind of lifelong monogamy in those kinds of social group living animals. So it's crazy to think that we're doing kind of lifelong pair bonding like birds. And yet people kind of moralize this. They're like, even if it's not natural, it's what we should aspire to, even if 55% of marriages end in divorce, even if infidelity causes huge amounts of drama, even if it leads people to split up in ways that lead parents not to get along if they're trying to deal with kids after a divorce.
I'm just going to ask a sort of basic question. Maybe it's silly, probably silly, I'm sure. But it seems that people just don't want this, the average person. It seems that the average person's pretty jealous and maybe lacks the emotional, I guess, development even to navigate something like this. I mean, are you maybe just being a little bit optimistic about the average human?
Oh, yeah. I think at this point in history, we've developed a whole culture of monogamy and a whole bunch of kind of love hacks and relationship hacks for how to manage expectations of monogamy. We have couples therapy. We have, you know, norms about romantic love and courtship. We have thousands of years of traditions that try to adapt a human brain that's not really built for monogamy to a social norm of monogamy. And maybe in 500 years, we'll have polyamory norms that are just as good at kind of adapting people to poly. Granted, at this point, I think only a minority of people would be any good at open relationships or poly. But the great thing about Mars colonization is you're already selecting, I think, exactly the kinds of people who would be good at open relationships. I think at the moment, to do good poly or good open relationships in current American culture, you need to have pretty high intelligence, high openness, which is a personality trait that's about being experimental and open-minded. You have to have a lot of emotional self-control. You have to be rational. And it helps to have low jealousy, low sexual jealousy, low emotional jealousy. So I think if you're selecting the kinds of people who would make good astronauts or Mars colonists, you're already selecting most of those traits. Now, most of those folks might not have personal experience of poly, but I think you could actually run them through a training program in a few months and give them some practice, just like you run them through training programs for how do you deal with low gravity or how do you deal with the technical challenges of running the spacecraft.
Wow, it's interesting. It's hard to hear. Even living in San Francisco, surrounded by the kinds of people I am, and I'm gay, so it's like out here, I think almost every gay relationship that I know is open to some degree. I was raised Catholic and I was raised in this world, and there's just this strong sense that I should be working towards monogamy. Do you see people really embracing this, or do you see people struggling with it because of the sorts of psychological blocks that I'm describing in myself right now?
Yeah, I think the two main blocks to polyamory are, number one, there's a steep learning curve in overcoming sexual jealousy. And number two, there's a lot of social stigma and expectations and moralizing about what a good and honorable and proper relationship should look like. And you're absolutely right. A lot of gay men have more kind of open or monogamish relationships where they don't expect sexual fidelity. And Dan Savage talks about this a lot in his podcast, Savage Love. And I think the poly community has actually learned a lot from gay male culture ever since the 70s about these, you know, how to be ethical and open and honest and responsible without being strictly monogamous. That's a challenge. Learning how to manage sexual jealousy is just not a skill that most Americans bother, you know, to confront. We actually right. think jealousy is a good thing. But if you look at how kids are taught to manage another very powerful emotion, anger, most kids get pretty good at inhibiting their anger by the time they reach high school.
You just said something so interesting to me, that we're taught that jealousy is a good thing. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's validated often as a kind of signal of how romantically serious you are. Like, it's thought by many Americans, if you don't feel jealous if your partner flirts with somebody else or has sex with someone else, then you mustn't love them, that it's not true love, that love and jealousy are so intertwined that one is a signal for the other. The polyamorous people have absolutely the opposite view. They say if you love somebody, you respect their sexual sovereignty and their sexual freedom, and you don't try to cage them in. And it's your job to manage your own sexual jealousy, not their job to minimize, you know, how much they trigger it.
So interesting. Yeah, last thing, just do you see this happening, sort of a wider social adoption of this in the shorter term, 10 years, or maybe longer term, or not at all?
I do see it growing. I mean, it's definitely a trend. If you look at the surveys among millennials and Gen Z, about half of them say that sexually exclusive monogamy is not their ideal relationship structure. And a lot of them are experimenting with other forms. What tends to happen is, like, they'll try polyamory in college. There's a lot of poly drama. If they try relationship anarchy, they get disappointed and heartbroken. They don't know what good poly looks like, and they tend to form a pair bond. And then they think, oh, if I formed a pair bond, and if one person's more important to me, that must be a sign that monogamy, after all, is the right way to do it. And nobody's told them you can have pair bonds plus poly, or you can have monogamish relationships. There's a lot of confusion. People are trying out lots of different ways of doing this. But I think there's a one-way trend towards a broader variety of relationship structures. And I am dead serious that I think a Mars colony would work better if everybody was poly and had jealousy management skills. And in fact, if they were also heteroflexible or bisexual.
Thank you. I mean, this was you just kind of threw a curveball at the end. Do you believe that there's malleability in sexual orientation, or will we just be selecting for people who happen to have some natural innate openness to attraction to the same gender? Or
I think the science says that a lot of women are naturally fairly fluid in their sexual orientation and kind of more open to bisexuality than men are. I think for men, it tends to be the case that most men are either pretty straight or pretty gay, and there aren't a lot of truly bisexual men. But I think you could at least select male astronauts who are at least heteroflexible, where there's kind of enough openness to the sexuality of other men that they're not freaking out if there's gay astronauts or if their partner is having sex with another guy.
Dr. Miller, this was such a cool interview, so different than what I'm used to, and I loved it. Robert Heinlein is known as one of the fathers of modern science fiction. He was writing in the 1940s and 50s, and even back then, writing then, there was this kind of sub-theme that ran through his work. Small groups of highly cerebral, ostensibly immortal, like hot libertarians, traveling through space and having sex with each other. In Stranger in a Strange Land, Heinlein's protagonist, Valentin Michael Smith, the man from Mars, is born among aliens and brings their way of thinking back to Earth. Among other things, including politics, adventure, a really interesting theory on laughter, actually, there's a lot of what you might term weird sex in this book. Interesting side, the novel's working title was Heretic. And is this kind of stuff our sexual future? So I'm not sure what exactly the Martian relationship is going to look like. Maybe in 100 years it's something close to what we're working with today. But what I do know is that our ability to manage our emotions, especially in confined spaces, absolutely has to change, along with our tolerance for different ways of loving and living. And because these traits will be essential early on in colonization, I think they're going to kind of seed the planet's culture. You can imagine what the Puritans did for America, but instead of an extremely conservative social outlook, I think it's going to be like free love and the scientific method. Now, we are getting very close to the end of our story. This season, we've looked at everything from spaceflight and terraforming to genetic engineering, material science, and a whole host of fringe, potentially paradigm-changing technologies. We're building a second home for humanity, and I think that we've sketched that out pretty well. But what happens when we're done? What comes next? We're going to be sharing just a bit more supplemental material, and then it's our season finale. We've traveled to new worlds within our solar system. Now, what about new stars? Next up, it's interstellar travel. And let's just go ahead and talk about the purpose of life. From Founders Fund, I'm Mike Solana, and this is Anatomy of Next, New World.